2106 Park Avenue in Chico. Affordable Automotive offers pickup and delivery service. Financing is also available. Appointments at 892-1774 and at chicoautomotive.com. Affordable Automotive is also looking for technicians to join their team. Call Mike Button at 892-1774 for details. And hey, if you enjoyed Fresh Hop Cinema, you can now go to kzfr.org and tip the show.
Hello, good evening. It's cold, nippy, Chico evening. You are listening to Ask Dr. Gale. Every December, I do my show on the meaning of Christmas and Hanukkah, on Christianity and Judaism, so that we have some background for the holidays. So that's what we're going to do tonight. I have an interview with Daniel Wielinger, who is the chair of the Comparative Religion Department at Chico State. Some of you may know him, really nice guy. And Rebecca Rappaport, she is studying to be a rabbi, so now she's the Reb of the Chico Jewish congregation, and she'll talk about Hanukkah and other things. But before we do that, I have in the studio with me a wonderful Chico State student named Hello. Megan Hammer.
Hi, I'm Megan.
And she does the technical work here at KZFR. And she has one more semester, and then she'll graduate from Chico State. Yes. So I thought that a lot of people who are listening or know people would like some kind of tips for finals, stress, Definitely. Holiday time. So, Megan, how are you feeling about finals next week? What's your emotional state?
I'm feeling okay. I've been pretty stressed and high strung. I think that a lot of other students are feeling that way, spending a lot of time overthinking and going back in your notes, doing that kind of work. But the hard work is always worth it. I think as a senior, I'm used to it, but also you can tell that you're just kind of over it and you're ready for the stress to be done. But emotionally a little stressed.
Okay, so let's do some stress reduction techniques.
Definitely.
Breathing is something we do all the time. We don't have to take it out of our pocket. So let's do some breathing. Yeah. So a long exhalation calms the parasympathetic nervous system. So the easiest thing to do is let's all take a deep breath in, and your belly rises, so it's deep. And an exhalation as long as you can, like you're keeping up a little feather.
Yeah.
And that just that long exhalation tells the body, calm down. That's a great tool. And another breathing that I like that's really simple is you breathe in with your tongue on the roof of the mouth. Hmm. And you breathe out with your tongue on the floor of the mouth. And what that does is connects the governing meridian that goes up the spine and comes down below the nose, and the central meridian that comes up from the pubic bone to the chin. So let's do that again. Breathe in, tongue on the roof of the mouth. Exhale, tongue on the floor of the mouth.
Yeah, you know, I was actually shaking while we were talking, and now I'm not shaking anymore, so I feel a lot calmer.
Brilliant. And when we get stressed, the blood in our brain centers in the amygdala, in the midbrain, and the amygdala is like, oh my God, anxious. Blah, blah, blah,
yeah, is that the fight or flight one?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So what we do before we take a test or do something that makes us nervous is put our hand on the forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And do the breathing. And what that does, it just reminds we want our blood, our focus in the prefrontal cortex where we're rational.
Yeah, and not back there.
Yeah, because if you get scared, then you forget, oh my God, I can't think of that. I know it, but I can't think of it. What's going
Definitely.
On? And so if that happens to anybody, put your hand on your prefrontal cortex on your forehead and breathe out. The other thing is when we get stressed, there's a kind of technique called brain gym, G-Y-M. And when we get stressed, they found we get lined up right side of the brain, right side of the body, left side of the brain, left side of the body, and that's called being homolateral.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're homolateral, we're fuzzy brain, klutzy, bump into things.
Oh,
I drop glasses, chatter glass.
Me too.
And
run into things.
Run into things. So the question is, well, what do you do about it? Mm-hmm. You want to be bilateral, so the right side of the brain is in alignment with the left side of the body, left side of the brain in alignment with the right side of the body. How do you do that? Cross crawl is the easiest.
Okay.
So you touch opposite elbow to opposite knee.
Okay.
And it's really even enhanced if you look at your hand as it crosses the midline of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes your eyes cross. Or you can just kind of doodle little horizontal figure eights.
Yeah. I've heard about the bilateral stimulation and how that like helps the brain.
Yeah, you can put your cross your arms and put your hands in your armpits.
Mm-hmm.
And And then emotional freedom technique. Have you heard of that?
I have not. No.
Emotional freedom technique was developed by a psychologist named Roger Callahan.
Mm-hmm.
He was working with a woman who was phobic about water.
Oh.
And they did traditional talk therapy for a year and a half, and she understood it, but she was still phobic. So he reached over and he tapped on her stomach meridian points under the eyes.
Ooh.
So these are the points on energy flows in the body that the Chinese identified thousands of years ago, and scientists have discovered really do exist.
Yeah, it's like that Tai Chi I've heard about with the hands. They are sensors in your hands, movement, and interesting on the eyes.
Well, yeah. there's
underneath.
So he developed a technique with different points,
mm-hmm.
and then a guy named Gary Craig simplified it. So he had one pattern that you tap on for everything.
Yeah.
So if you go to the internet and search emotional freedom technique manual, Gary Craig developed it, and then there's other groups that are hopped on board, and they have free manuals. And so if someone is really anxious about a test, then I would do the tapping.
The tapping. Wow. Yeah. These are great tips. I'm definitely going to try that this week, next week when I have those tests, because you get clouded when you sit there and you start to panic, and those things can really help calm you down. And if you have a clear mind, you'll remember what you learned.
Yeah. You know, I do intuitive coaching work, and I worked with a woman who failed her RN exam,
mm-hmm.
and then she worked with me and passed, and what helped her is to think about calling on her pretend fairy godmother to kind of feed her answers.
Oh my gosh. Wow. A pretend fairy godmother. I want one of those.
Or you could do the guide on the other dimension who knows the most about your topic.
Oh my gosh. That's my new thing for sure. I'm doing that. I'm calling upon my fairy godmother to help me through finals week.
Awesome. That's cool. And then every Wednesday night, we're part of Shalom Free Clinic at 1010 Mangrove, and I do chakra balancing, and a woman named Liz, who's an RN, does Reiki. So if anybody mm-hmm. wants to come in next Wednesday and get balanced, we're at 1010 Mangrove. It's free.
Yeah.
It's from 5 to 7 behind Access Dental.
That sounds super fun. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear from Daniel.
But first, we better thank our supporters.
Oh, that's true. Of course. Of course. All right. Let's do that.
Ask Dr. Gale is made possible by the generous contributions of KZVR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. And Ask Dr. Gale is also made possible by Drunken Dumplings. I tried them the other day and it was good. First created as a food cart, Drunken Dumplings is now a dine-in restaurant serving locally sourced, fresh, handmade Asian fusion comfort food at 1414 Park Avenue, Suite 120, behind Nobby's, which is a hamburger place. It's open 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Details on Facebook, Instagram, and at drunkendumplingschico.com. Drunken Dumpling, where they love food, flavor, and our community. And last but not least, Ask Dr. Gale is made possible by D.A. Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR and Community Radio in Northern California. For more information, visit D.A. Lampe Construction, Com. Okay, we've been awesome. Dying to hear from Daniel Wiedlinger about what's happening at Christmas time historically.
Awesome. Let's hear.
Daniel, thank you very much for talking.
Learn more about how the universe operates, not just how to calculate things. And then I took some elective courses in world religions, and I really enjoyed it a great deal. And I ended up switching to religious studies. And that's basically how I got into that. Pardon me. So I ended up majoring in religious studies for my undergrad. And then I went to, I did a master's in Eastern religions at Carleton University in Ottawa. And then I went to University of Chicago where I did my PhD in South Asian studies. So South Asia, just to be clear, is basically India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, that area. So I studied that, and then I got my job here in Chico, and I've been here ever since.
You know, there's kind of a stereotype that Canadians are really nice. Do you find that they are nicer than people that you know in the States?
It depends what you mean by nice. I've talked about this a lot with people, actually, and I think that they are more polite, but they are not necessarily friendlier. In fact, Americans are probably friendlier in the sense that they're more willing to invite you over and kind of slap you on the back and say, how are you doing? But Canadians are a little more polite, maybe we'll say. But Canadians are a little bit more reserved, I think, than Americans, which comes from a closer connection, of course, to Britain, which is a more reserved society as well. So I think that definitely has to do with it.
Got it. And then what drove you to Buddhism? Just being an expert.
So, as you said, I grew up in a Jewish family, and my grandfather was a rabbi. I went to a Jewish private school growing up, so I learned a lot about Judaism. Then, as I said, I was interested in physics, and I kind of fell out of it and got more interested in religious studies. So once I had to focus on religion, I figured I'd already gone to a Jewish school for all of my elementary years, so I wanted to do something different. We live in a Christian society, so just by living in North America, one learns a lot about Christianity just by seeing what goes on around you. So I wanted to learn something totally different, and that's how I got interested in Eastern religions, so Hinduism and Buddhism. And I just happened to take a course that was really, really good, where they got us excited about the ideas in those religions. And that kind of is what helped me focus on it.
Mm-hmm. What I'm interested in talking about is how much of the Bible has been changed over the centuries. Like biblical scholar Bart Ehrman, who used to be an evangelical Christian, he writes about how the Bible has changed over the centuries. Scribes change things according to mistakes or their whim or whatever. So what do we know about the historical Jesus, let's say?
Yeah, so this is a very important point. In fact, coming from a science background, as I said, many people like to use science to kind of counter a lot of the claims of various religions, Christianity, Judaism, and other ones, and say, well, look, it says in your Bible or your sacred text that this happened, but science tells us that that happened. And therefore, I don't know if I'm going to believe in your religious text.
Like, but the earth was created in 6 days, which,
yes, exactly,
we know,
but
it
we know it's at least 8 or 9 days is what science is telling us. So,
the Big Bang was instantaneous.
Exactly right. Well, actually, interestingly enough, many people don't realize this, but when the scientific idea of the Big Bang was developed, it was actually scientists who were most concerned about it, and many religious leaders welcomed the idea, because actually they felt that the idea of the Big Bang, like a huge flash of light, you know, from one moment to the next out of which the world emerged, they felt that that actually cohered better with the Bible, and many scientists were concerned that what they were discovering was so similar to the kind of thing described in the Bible that was making them feel a little bit ill at ease. So, you know, not all science certainly not all science is used to problematize the various religious claims. Often science helps them. And, of course, many religious people have been scientists, and many scientists have been religious. So getting back to that, the point I wanted to make was that while many people think science is the best tool to really highlight problems in religion, actually the religious texts themselves have a lot of internal inconsistencies. So when we're talking about using religious texts like the Bible as a historical document and trying to look at what it tells us about any figure, be it Moses, Jesus, or Adam, it's very difficult to tease out what might be the truth from those claims and what might be myths that have arisen over time. And there's two basic problems, right? Two basic problems. One of them is that within the text itself, there are internal inconsistencies. And of course, in the New Testament, this is most obvious by the fact that we have four Gospels.
Matthew, Mark,
the Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Mark, right? So it says right there that these are the same story according to different people. If they were all going to say the same thing, then there wouldn't need to be four books, right? There would just be one. So the thing is that within the text, there are inconsistencies within them. In fact, biblical scholars have detected something like 120 inconsistencies amongst the four Gospels, for example, where they're talking about the same string of events, but yet mention different things, a different order of things. Some people are present in one story and they're not present in the other story at a certain event. There's some debate about who Joseph's father was, right? So Joseph, the father of Mary, mother of Jesus. In Matthew, I believe, it says his father's name was Jacob. In Luke, it says his father's name was Heli. So there's all sorts of inconsistencies within the text. And then the other problem is that there are different texts, different versions of the text, right? So even within the accepted version that the various, that the church committees have decided this is the official version, even within that there are inconsistencies. But we also forget that there are many other versions of the Bible that were out there.
Gospel there are of hundreds Mary, of different manuscripts. Thomas.
Oh, yeah, right, okay. Well, yeah, so let's be clear. Yeah, there's even, yeah, so there's yet another problem. So I'm just saying, I'm just talking about Matthew. Like, let's say the Gospel of Matthew. There are many different ancient manuscripts of Matthew, and they are slightly different, right? That's what I mean. Yeah, so yeah, there's yet another problem, that there are also Gospels that never made it into the official collection, but were written, and again, tell a similar but slightly different story. So there's just many, many, many problems with thinking of the Bible that you might see in on a bookshelf in a modern house today, taking that as somehow a document that you can use to learn about history is just very, very problematic on a number of levels, right? And forgetting all the mythology in it that obviously is going to be scientifically problematic. I mean, just forget about all that stuff for a minute. Just the very fact that that Bible that you pick up on your bookshelf and read consists of a text that was chosen from a few different manuscripts with different versions and was chosen from a few different books, as you say, that weren't even put into the Bible but are still out there and say different things and were written back then at the same time. So why should we believe the versions in the Bible and not these other ancient texts that were written at similar times, exactly as you say. So these create a lot of problems, not to mention that there are inconsistencies in the Bible itself. So you might say, ah, I see, so-and-so did such and such, but then the Gospel of Luke says so-and-so did something else. So which one of those ones do you believe? So to try to construct history out of it becomes very, very difficult. With one more compounding factor, and that is that there is very, very little, outside the Bible that can corroborate the claims in the various biblical texts, right? So the Romans did not make records of a man called Jesus, or Yeshu, I guess would have been his Hebrew name, being crucified at that time. So it's not like we can go to the Roman archives and find mentions of this happening. It's only mentioned in the Gospels. And a few people wrote about it a couple of decades later. Josephus Flavius mentions it very briefly, I think in about the year 90. So that would have been, 60 years later. So it's just very difficult to know what is and is not true in these texts.
Is there a particular orientation, methodology, slant propaganda point of view that dictated which ones were chosen? I mean, is it making a point we pick Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John rather than Thomas, Mary, whatever, because it points to this belief?
There's no question that the texts that were chosen to be included were chosen because they had certain messages that the Council of Church Leaders wanted to be put across. So, you know, there's a Gospel of Thomas that I think was found relatively recently, and it says some things that are slightly different. It focuses on some more, I guess you could call it, esoteric elements of the identity of Jesus. So, of course, as I'm sure the viewers know, or the listeners know, the exact nature of Jesus was a big subject of debate in the early church, whether he was a prophet, whether he was God himself, whether he was part God and part man, right? All of these were discussed and debated, and different Gospels emphasize different aspects. The Gospel of John, for example, emphasizes his divinity somewhat more than the other Gospels do. So there's all sorts of, and some of the Gospels emphasize more his humanity, and they were probably aimed at slightly different communities. So the one that emphasized his humanity and the idea that he's a wise prophet, but not necessarily talking so much about the idea of him being God, would have been aimed more towards the Jewish people, right, who in their religion, unlike the Greeks, right, in their religion, they don't have an idea already that God can come down to earth in human form. So the Gospels that are aimed towards the Jews would be more focusing on his continuation with the Jewish tradition. The ones written in Rome for the Greek and Roman peoples would feel more comfortable emphasizing his divine aspects. And so they would be chosen for various reasons like that.
Yeah, what interests me is it seems like the crucifixion is really a central event for Christians because it meant he was divine, that he arose from the dead. But there's an ancient pagan tradition that you kill the king in order, you sacrifice the ruler and around the time that Jesus was, that we celebrate Christmas, in order to ensure a fertile spring.
Yes.
So is there any, was this a pagan overlay that fit the mentality of the time, the risen king, or is there any evidence that in fact the tomb, you know, the stone was rolled away from the tomb and his women followers found him?
Right, well, certainly there's no evidence for that ever having happened. Again, there's no evidence 100% for Jesus having existed at all, right, other than the Gospels themselves. So all we know about the stone that was moved comes from the Gospels themselves. So there's no external corroborating evidence or anything like that. But I think your point about pre-existing traditions in the region of kings being sacrificed in order to ensure a great harvest is certainly an element that went into it. And I think that, like all religions, Christianity includes ideas from a bunch of different belief systems that were going on at the time. So we have
you
the Jewish
are
belief
listening
in the Messiah
to KCFR
that had existed before
90.1 FM. This is Ask Dr. Gail's show. I would love to hear from you. I want to know if anybody's listening or if it's just Megan and me here. And my email is gkimble@csuchico.edu. So as you know, this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. If you're just joining us, we're doing my traditional December show, which is to talk to experts about the meaning of Christmas and Hanukkah. And we're kind of finishing up with Daniel Wielinger, who is the chair of the Comparative Religion Department at Chico State. And soon we'll hear from Reb Rappaport, who heads the Jewish congregation here. So keep on listening.
In India, in, of course, Europe, all of these places, the idea of sacrifice, that human beings owe something to God, and that we want to make a sacrifice of some valuable item that goes up as an offering to God and shows our faith in God, and then hopefully we will get some sort of benefit from God in return, right? So that's a very basic feature of many, many religions all over the world. So in the case of Christianity, the crucifixion of Jesus is simply a kind of sacrifice that is known in religions all over the world. We have some valuable item, in this case Jesus, who's offered up to God, and through that, some good thing happens to people. Now, the details of what that good thing is can vary widely amongst the religions. In the case of Christianity, of course, it's that our souls will be saved. But the basic idea of offering something is certainly, I don't know which specific pagan group it might have come from, but it certainly is there. And of course, within Judaism as well, Judaism focused heavily on sacrifice. So there's no doubt that that emerges out of a Jewish tradition as well.
Didn't Abraham have to sacrifice? He had to sacrifice his son. And then at the end, God said, no, you don't really have to do it.
Yes, exactly right. So that was an early example of sacrifice in Judaism. And of course, one of the most pertinent ones was the sacrifice on the Day of Atonement. So where Jews where the lamb would be sacrificed by the high priest. And note that it was sacrificed specifically as an atonement for the sins of the people. So in other words, that lamb has to die in order so that the people's sins can be forgiven. And this was a well-known idea within Judaism. So the idea of Jesus simply being that lamb who dies for our sins is very contiguous with Judaic ideas, really.
Every Christmas, I say to the kids who are gathered, I want you to know that we're celebrating the birth of Jesus, who is a radical. He violated Old Testament taboos. He bore witness to women. He traveled with women. He said, Mary hath chosen the better part, talking with me, than Martha in the kitchen. And that's why he was killed, is because he violated all kinds of Old Testament and, I guess, Roman laws. Is that an accurate thing I'm telling those kids?
It's certainly accurate that he violated a lot of the laws. The Old Testament has a lot of laws that Jews are enjoined to follow. There's traditionally 613 of these laws. And in fact, this is not completely unique. Many of the great prophets, I mentioned Isaiah already as one of the early prophets that spoke about the idea of a Messiah. But Isaiah is also very famous for talking about the idea that God, of course, lays down a lot of rules for us to follow. But he cares a lot more about the purity of our hearts and the goodness of our intent than following a lot of these rules to the letter. And in fact, having spoken about the Day of Atonement, one of the things that Isaiah says is that, yes, God commands that we fast on the Day of Atonement, that we're not allowed to eat. But if you follow the letter of the law by not fasting, but yet treat women badly, treat children badly, treat strangers badly, then God will be more angry than if you were to break the fasting rule but still be nice to the people around you. So the teachings of Jesus are very much within that prophetic tradition that's already there in Judaism, but he took it a step further and explicitly did talk in a number of places about the idea that we don't have to follow the laws that much anymore. So of course that angered people. However, that's not really why he would have been killed, because traditionally the Jewish council in Palestine in those days didn't kill people for breaking the laws. In fact, although it is true that in the Jewish parts of the Bible, right, the Old Testament in Hebrew, there are some punishments for breaking certain rules that do require death, there's almost no evidence that those were ever really carried out. So the Jewish tradition was not one in which there were heavy punishments for breaking rules. It was assumed that God is the one who punishes you, right? So if you break these rules, then if God sees fit, he will punish you. And it's not really up to, I think that you can count on one hand the amount of times that the Sanhedrin, which is the name of the Jewish council that ruled the area, probably on one hand the amount of times they actually handed out a death penalty to somebody for breaking law. So that's not why Jesus would have been, the Jews didn't kill him, the Romans did, but But according to the story, you know, he was handed over and whatnot. So the reason that that would have happened would be just because he was presumably causing a lot of problems with the Romans, right? So it's not the breaking of the Jewish laws that was really the problem, although of course angered people. But the real reason was that he was shaking things up with Rome. And the Romans didn't like that because he was saying that he was, you know, the king of the Jews, but of course the Roman emperor was supposed to be the ultimate ruler of the areas. So there was distress about that. And from the Jewish standpoint, while yes, they would have been upset that he was not following the rules in the way they wanted it, I mean the religious rules, they were a lot more upset by the idea that he was angering the Romans, and at any time the Romans could come and try to punish him and by extension all of the Jewish people for this trouble. And of course, shortly thereafter they did. And the temple was indeed destroyed by Rome, and the Jews were exiled from the area. Not because of what Jesus was doing, but because of, you know, there were other uprisings and stuff. There was a Bar Kokhba rebellion where they spoke out against the Romans, and there was a lot of difficulties because of that. So, I mean, those fears were not ill-placed.
If I understand this correctly, Catholics say that you can get rid of your sins by confessing to a priest and doing a penance like this many Hail Marys. But Protestants, according to Luther, Martin Luther, said that it's only by grace. You can't do works. It's only by your faith, and you just hope that you're going to be the one who is given the grace to be saved and not have eternal damnation. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's a pretty big difference between those different groups as far as I understand it. Yes, certainly the Protestants focus more on the idea of grace. And again, interestingly enough, this is not just a feature that is found in Christianity, but there are many religions around the world that have this kind of discussion about the idea of, well, how much can we as mere humans do to help ourselves achieve a higher state, get to heaven, or whatever it may be, versus how much do we have to rely upon God or the gods or whatever they happen to believe in, but how much do we rely upon them to bring us to a state of salvation? This happens in Buddhism as well, for example, and in many other religions. But yeah, that's certainly a central question.
Right, because in Mahayana Buddha, they would say the bodhisattvas can give you grace in a way and help you.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. So in Mahayana, there's often more of a focus on the power of other divine beings to help us. In Theravada Buddhism, there's often more of a focus on yourself through diligent meditation can achieve a state of nirvana. Exactly right. So there's similar debates that go on in a number of different religions. In Hinduism, this is also a debate in various forms of Vaishnavism. In fact, in Hinduism, they've got a really interesting metaphor that they use. They call it the way of the monkey and the way of the cat. So the way of the monkey is when people believe that their deeds can help them get to heaven. The way of the cat is when they believe that it's really God who brings you there. Why? Because a baby monkey actively clings to the mother as she goes around in the jungle, whereas a cat is picked up by the neck of the mother and just kind of flailing, doesn't really do anything. So our relationship to God is kind of like the monkey, where we actively hold on, and if we let go, we'll fall. Or the cat, where it's just purely God, right? He just picks us up and we don't have anything. I just think it's a really interesting image, so I wanted to mention it.
I love it. I love it. So Christianity was a small kind of cult, you could say. Why did it become the largest religion in the world? Why isn't it Judaism or Taoism or Zoroastrianism?
Yeah, well, that's obviously one of the most difficult questions that religious scholars have. So I won't be able to answer in a few minutes here. But certainly there's a few key elements. One is that we forget that in the ancient world, before monotheism, there were many different gods, and different regions had their own local gods. So, you know, Athena might have been worshipped in Athens and not in other places, and other places had their own local god. So what that does is, in trying to organize an empire like the Roman Empire, it's a little more difficult to do that when everybody has their own local gods, and they each think that their own local gods are in charge of their kind of particular area, and their power gets weaker as you get farther from the area. Introducing the idea of one god who rules over everybody is definitely a strategy that can make the imperial ruler more powerful, because people, instead of associating him with a Roman god, but yet that Roman god isn't really god of the whole world anyway, if you associate the ruler with the great god, the one god who rules everybody, that sort of gives the ruler even more power than associating him with the existing gods that are only local gods and not really ruling over everywhere. So for sure, everywhere that monotheistic religions have emerged, they have often gone hand in hand with the imperial leadership and been locked together so that they kind of justify each other, and the mythology of the religion ends up giving more power and legitimacy to one great ruler who rules over everybody in a way that's kind of analogous to the way that one god rules over everybody. So we see a similar thing in Islam, where Islam also spread very rapidly, and a large part of it was because monotheism just works as a legitimizing scheme in people's minds to make the emperor or the ruler that much more powerful. So once the Roman emperors heard about Christianity, and of course, as you know, they first oppressed it, but Constantine had a dream, or maybe he did or maybe he didn't, but the myth is that he had a dream in which I believe a cross was floating above him, and then he went to battle and won, so he became Christian. But whatever reason, the fact is that one emperor decided to adopt Christianity as the official religion. And once he did so, it did help to consolidate things just in the way I've talked about. It's just easier to rule a place where there's one god than when there's all sorts of many different local gods. So just by virtue of the fact that he happened to be the emperor of the most powerful empire in the world at that time, that's one quick way that Christianity suddenly became a very important world religion.
Well, if you want to see more, you want to finish up with Daniel, you can see the interview on my YouTube channel. So just search Gail Kimball YouTube, and I have lots of interesting interviews there. So if you're just tuning in, this is Ask Dr. Gail. I'm Gail Kimball. I'd love to hear from you. gkimball@csuchico.edu. I'm here with Megan Hammer, who's
Hello.
Doing the tech work. She's great. Graduating next semester from Chico State. And our next speaker is Rebecca Rappaport, who's the almost rabbi of the Chico Jewish congregation. So let's hear about the meaning of Hanukkah. Well, we're trying to hear from about the meaning of Hanukkah. It has to do with a festival of lights, and she pointed out in the interview that it's not a high holiday. It's not like a big sacred holiday for Jews, but it's kind of been adapted because it occurs around Christmas. So it had to do with light that in the temple that was supposed to only last one day, but it lasted for 8 hours. So let's see if we got some. Daniel.
Yeah, let's finish with Daniel. Unfortunately, that sound did not come through.
But you can see it on the on my YouTube channel.
Definitely, and you have this book. It's actually not her.
Technical difficulties. Thank goodness. Thank goodness that that Megan is here to deal with this. So just a reminder, every Wednesday, 5 to 7, drop in energy balancing Reiki
part of temple life and Jewish ritual.
Hey, Megan,
centralized location. Jewish study became much more the domain, and you know, that people did that in their own local, you know, synagogues or yeshivas. But what men did is they continued that through study and prayer, and women continued to maintain the household. So that's what I would say the biblical root is in the liberal Jewish world, either religiously or in the secular Jewish world. I would say that the lines dividing men and women in terms of leadership roles or things that traditionally used to have been what women do or what men do, there is a lot of much more equality. And, you know, just for instance, even me being able to pursue becoming a rabbi, and men, you know, doing more of the child rearing and being home. So it's much more in the very traditional Orthodox Jewish world that those roles are much more, you know, there's a division between them. Well, I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does. But I'm thinking of the requirement that women have a mitzvah, the ritual bath after any issue of blood, childbirth, or menstruation. And so that suggests that there's a kind of contaminant quality about women. They're not supposed to touch the food and stuff when they're on their menstrual cycle. Does that kind of bleed into attitudes towards women, or is that really separate?
I mean, it depends on which Jewish community you're in. And it, you know, a lot of those things. So I would say that a lot of things are missed in translation. So what we would call ritual impurity, which is when a woman is menstruating and they're not supposed to do certain things, just even in the translation of that word, a lot of things are missed, because in Hebrew, that word, the words for pure and impure that we translate are tahor and tameh. And it's more about ritual preparedness, mm-hmm. or readiness. You have a dog that wants to participate in this conversation.
She's a puppy. She's only 3 months old, so she uh-huh. doesn't know how to behave.
Yeah. So I think that in some circles, it would be viewed as an issue of impurity, and women taking that on at a very deep self-esteem level, that there's something impure about being on your period, you know, menstruating, or something about me that's wrong. That can definitely be interpreted that way. But depending on how you learn about this and what community you're in, it's also can also be seen as ritual preparedness. So when you are menstruating, for instance, the belief or the idea there is that that is a loss of potential life, a life that could have become is not happening. And so there's a little bit of a grieving or a mourning of that potential. You're not in a place of being ready to make new life at that point, right? And so that's why there's a separation between a husband and a wife. This is very, you know, sort of gender stratified stuff. But this is how it technically came to be. And when you are ritually ready, you know, the whole mitzvah basically centering on be fruitful and multiply, which comes from Torah, right? Fill the earth with life is the mitzvah. If you're not ritually ready to do that because you're menstruating, there's some separation between men and women. And when you're at your most peak and fertile time, that's when you would come together. And so, yes, it can be interpreted as something wrong or impure, or actually a heightened state of connection to the ability to create. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Interesting. Let's jump ahead, because we're just finishing Hanukkah. And so the Festival of Lights, when I grew up, my Jewish friends had Hanukkah bushes. They played with the dreidel. They thought they were special because they got presents for 8 days. But my understanding is it's not really that sacred of a holiday in traditional Judaism.
I would say, it's a holiday commemorating historical events, and is a time for family to be together and an exploration of light and dark from a more mystical, Kabbalistic level. In terms of being a Torah holiday, it's not, and its place on the calendar, it's not a synagogue holiday, so it doesn't have that same heft that, say, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur would have, or even the same, you know, Passover is much more of a home family holiday, too. It doesn't have quite that same heft to it, but I think because of where it falls in the calendar, at least in the United States, there's been an attempt to either feel part of the festival, the festive time of November, December, January, or, you know, for Jewish kids to feel like that they're not so different. So there, it's a complicated holiday for Jews, actually, Hanukkah, because as you're saying, it's actually quite a minor holiday and is very humble in its rituals of, you know, lighting the menorah. The gift giving is a very minor part of a holiday that's even a minor holiday, but it's definitely been amped up during this season. I mean, there's nothing wrong with giving gifts, but trying to turn it into the Jewish Christmas is complex and complicated and comes with pitfalls and gifts. And we can talk more if you have any specific questions about, we call it the December dilemma. And as there are more interfaith families, it becomes even more complex, right? Because you don't want to deny the beauty of the December holidays for a family where both of those holidays are side by side sometimes.
Right. So what was the historic event that Hanukkah celebrates?
So as, I mean, this is probably repetitive for a lot of people, and I don't know how much depth you want me to go in. So just, you know, stop me if I'm going into too much depth. So it's a story that takes place long, long ago during the time, I would say, of the Second Temple, which is around 70 CE. And at that point, that was this was the spiritual center that was considered the most special and holy for the Jewish people. And there was a cruel leader, King Antiochus, who was ruling over the Jewish people and disliked the Jews and saw that they were different and worshipped in ways that were different and foreign, and ultimately began to outlaw Jewish religion and Jewish practice and ordered Jews actually to worship Greek gods. And as we know, this is a major prohibition in Judaism to worship gods other than the one God, right? So that became like, we don't engage in idol worship. And so this oppression of religious and spiritual freedom ultimately culminated in the year 168 BCE when the king ordered a massacre and basically a very devastating desecration of the sacred center of the Holy Temple. Shall I keep going?
Yeah, no, I've got to find the end here.
Exactly. And so the Jews of Judea, led by a small band, the Maccabees, wanted to fight back. And so part of the story that some Jews like to relate to is this idea of the small underdog taking on the big establishment and winning. You know, there's this idea of fighting for our right to worship in the way that that is meaningful to us, and that people can't take that away from us. So there was a battle, and ultimately the Jews won under the leadership of the Maccabees. And then there was this work to restore the temple. And the word Hanukkah actually means to rededicate. And so that's what they were doing, is cleaning up and rededicating the temple, and found this one, you know, small cruse of oil that they thought, oh, wow, this is only going to last one day in the lamp. And the oil actually lasted 8 days. And so that's where the symbolic miracle of the 8 days. So, you know, when we tell this story, it's like, oh, it's the miracle of the light. It's also about revolutionary, you know, fighting for one's rights. It's about bringing light to a dark time. It's about rededication of sacred space. And I'm sure a lot of people know about the fried foods that we eat during Hanukkah, you know, the potato pancakes, the latkes, or in Israel, the donut, the jelly-filled donut is another fried food. But those remind us of the oil, that of the candles, that it lasted for 8 days. So the joy of eating delicious potato latkes reminds us, you know, of this miraculous oil that lasted for 8 days. That, in a nutshell, I think, is what the historical components of the holiday are.
Great. The Jewish tradition is prophetic. There's many prophets. And could you clarify what the contemporary Jewish attitude is towards Jesus as a prophet? They also, the prophets said there will be a Messiah who will bring salvation. Why did they decide Jesus didn't fulfill that function?
So I would say the prophetic tradition, and again, you know, I want to make it clear that I'm speaking from a liberal Jewish perspective. So there is no one particular way to look at any of these questions that you're asking. So, but the prophetic tradition, I mean, as we know, the Torah has a section, the prophets, the Nevi'im, who were primarily, their function was primarily to call out the unholy behavior of basically the time of the monarchy, you know, after the land was established, you know, Canaan was established, and a system of monarchy was being set up. The prophets were the first ones to say, this is feeling a little corrupt. It's not, there's a lot of injustice going on. So there was the prophetic prophets who could see what was going to happen. You know, if you pursue this, if you go down this road, devastating things are going to happen. The prophets were also seen as people of comfort, so that after the devastation and exile and diaspora and you know, returning to a land that was devastated, could provide comfort and say that actually, you know, God will never forsake you. You know, even though all this destruction happened, God will not forsake you. I think that the prophetic tradition of calling out injustice and saying that the world is only perfected when everybody is treated equally is part of the prophetic tradition as well. I forgot the second part of your question.
Oh, why did they decide that Jesus didn't fit the description of a Messiah, a savior, in the prophetic tradition?
So the messianic era, the messianic time, is when the world is perfected. You know, it's and this is not something that's talked about so much in Judaism, like front and center, because what is paramount is living life here now and doing everything we can to perform mitzvot and tzedakah, acts of righteousness, and tikkun olam, repairing the world and perfecting this world. And this idea of an afterlife, or we call it in Judaism olam haba, the world that is coming, there's less emphasis placed on that. But if we are talking about the world that is coming, the messianic age or the messianic era, it's one where all of the inequity and sort of evil and nastiness that we find in this world is not around anymore. And since, from a Jewish perspective, that has not been realized or manifested, Jesus was not the Messiah, but a profound teacher, prophet in his own right, but not the Messiah.
I never hear Jews talk about looking in the future for a Messiah to bring about this salvation. Do you hear people talk about it, or is it like not?
Well, again, it's like I said, it's more like when we perfect the world here, then it's more, and this again is from a liberal Jewish perspective, the messianic age will come, not so much that a Messiah who will save us or redeem us will come, but that it'll be a time that is similar to, like, it's called Edenic time, right? Like Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, prior to the expulsion, you know, where everything was just sort of perfect and wonderful. And, you know, we hadn't made that one mistake of eating from the tree of knowledge, and you know, which created notions of free will and all of that. You know, once we're treating each other with respect and kindness worldwide all the time, that is the messianic age and the messianic era. But it's not that one person necessarily will come and save us.
So what's the idea of the afterlife? Is it that there's heaven and angels, or what's in liberal Judaism, what's the afterlife like?
So again, that's a wide spectrum. And I would say that two primary things come to mind. So it's less about like angels and heavenly realm, although we do speak of shamayim, heaven, you know, which is the divine realm. So I would say two things. One is that there is in, and it's more in, I think, mystical strains of Judaism, of the idea of reincarnation, of, and it's called Gilgul, where it's kind of like another attempt on the wheel, another time to come around. Gilgul is like a turning or a wheel. But I would say the primary, and again, this is just from a more liberal perspective, is that we're on the material plane, in the physical plane, and then there is this heavenly divine realm. And the work of humans is to bring those two worlds together every day, in any moment, where the spiritual and the material can meet. And we call that space holiness. And there are a lot of Jewish rituals that bring us into this space where we're attempting to bring heaven and earth together. And that's part of why we have a body, right? And a physical way of bringing that, so that we have a soul, and it's called our neshama, and it's inhabiting our physical being. When we die, the physical body stops working because it's subject to the laws of the physical world, right? Like our heart can't beat forever and our nerves can't keep firing forever. I mean, this is a physical thing that wears out at some point. But the soul, our neshama, this life force that comes from an original source of life itself, that returns to the sacred realm, to God, to the Holy One, however we want to call that. So there's this idea of returning to the original landscape, the original space, the original source of life itself. And then perhaps there is an idea of reincarnation in Gilgul, depending on which branch of Judaism you're in. And not that any, you know, the branches overlap with each other too. So I think those would be the ideas of the afterlife.
Is it fair to say that the three Abrahamic religions have a similar view then of the afterlife, that there's a spiritual dimension that, and they also, I think they also have the idea, all three of the Abrahamic religions, that there's also a hell or Gethsemane or some kind of place of punishment too. Do they all share that?
I mean, I can only speak for Judaism, and those concepts of heaven and hell as understood, say, in Christianity, do not exist in Judaism. I mean, there are metaphorical ways of probably looking at that, but there is not a hell. There is not a punishment realm. And heaven is more like what I said, that it's a returning to an original source of the energy of the universe. That's, you know, this oneness of everything. There's a way of referring to God has many aspects in Judaism, because how can you harness and name the unnameable and the ungraspable? But one way of thinking about God is something called Ein Sof, which means without end. It's just sort of the infinite energy of the universe. Say that's more what the soul returns to. That's what's actually animating our body, is that. Just in this particular form, I'm here being me and you're there being you. But once the form falls away, the life force that's animating returns to its source.
I think I remember reading that it says in the Old Testament that Prophet Isaiah was incarnated as John the Baptist, or maybe it's in the New Testament. So that some people cite that as a reference to reincarnation in the Bible.
Oh. I'm not familiar with that, but I believe you. I believe that.
Yeah. It's striking to me in the books that I've written about change makers, visionary scientists, people in the forefront of liberation movements, way more are Jewish than are representative of the Jewish population of the world. And you know, we think of Einstein and Freud and Marx and people who've really shaped our Western world. Why is that?
So, you know, any of these questions you're asking, you know, there are, you know, books and books written on that, you know, those singular topics. So just, you know, taking a small swipe at a question like that, I would say that it's probably, you could boil it down to two things. So you know, back to the original question with men being the ones who are studying Torah and studying, you know, keeping that tradition alive, that they're, because, let's see, let's put it this way, because Jews for most of their history have had some level of persecution and an exile and diasporic movement, like, you know, never really being settled, right? So it's this portable religion that because of that, there's been a